How's everybody doing? Hoping you're having a fantastic day. I'm back at least for a week. I'm not, as a note, I will be gone again for another week. I'm going down to Florida. I'll be near St. Augustine. So if I'll be able to go, I'll go to Mass. You're about to get jealous, Astro. I'm going to be able to go to Mass at, because do you know about the history of St. Augustine?
St. Augustine in America?
Yeah, in America. It's St. Augustine, Florida. So
no.
St. Augustine, it's called the first city in America, the oldest city in America.
Oh, interesting.
It has the longest, how do they put it? I think it's like the longest continuous, Catholic parish in America.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, the building itself, I think, is over 300 years old. But the like parish, the St. Augustine parish sort of is continuously goes back 500 years.
I see.
So yeah, I'll be able to go to Mass at that cathedral. It's pretty cool. Let me look at the.
Is it Latin Mass or Novus Ordo?
Oh, it's as Novus Ordo as as anything. It's yeah. They if it's a cool building, de facto it's gonna be Novus Ordo. In America, at least. Let me see. But the building is glorious. Oh, we love you, Wagner. Oh, I love you guys, too. Okay, bam.
Yeah, we love Wagner.
Glorious. Glorious.
Yeah, this is beautiful.
Mm. And it's actually in, like, the... Because if you look at this... Let me see if I can get it bigger. If you look at this, it's, like, in a sort of... it's not in a usual... Like American, it put me. Sorry, it opened up in a new tab, so I'll show him to get the. Okay, there it goes. So if you look at this, it's not in like a normal sort of American style, and a lot of like American parishes, it's what is it? It's probably like would it be called neo-Gothic?
Neo-Gothic.
Yeah, but these, it's in the Hispanic model. I don't know. If I went to like, I don't know, Mexico, I would assume that I would see buildings in this style. But yeah, so it has like a sort of Hispanic flair to it because Florida was actually, it was under the control of Spain until the early 19th century, I think. When did Florida become a part of America? 1845. 1821 is when it became a territory. So yeah, it was under Spanish rule until 1820. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that is So that's my wonderful
wonderful plan. News.
My wonderful plan is to go to be able to go to daily Mass there. It seems fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Mashallah. Is it mashallah?
No, it's inshallah.
Inshallah.
Yeah, if God wills.
So true. So Hassan is doing something stupid this morning. Probably wasting his time doing something dumb, but here.
He was actually writing his finishing up his thesis.
Nerd. My thesis, bro. My thesis. my thesis, dude. Okay, so what questions are we going to answer today? Astro's a lot nicer than Hassan, so Astro's not going to brutally just destroy you if you ask a dumb question, but I will. So St. Thomas says in Matthew 24:36, I didn't know St. Thomas wrote Matthew's gospel. That's cool.
Bro, come on. You didn't know that?
He's like, come on. And so, however, no one knows the day or the hour. Ah, it's the day or the hour.
Yeah.
Verse. Okay. When Jesus is speaking Jesus is speaking anthropomorphically. Why does the Son speak in this way? Is it to express that he receives all from the Father? So do you have a particularly strong take, Astro, on which interpretation to use of Matthew 24:36?
Okay. So I've heard that there are two interpretations. One comes from St. Basil, where he says that the reason that the Greek actually says that it's not that Son doesn't know the hour, it's that the Son wouldn't know if the Father did not know. So St. Basil reads this in that fashion, in the manner that there's an eternal generation, and the Son knows precisely because the Father knows. So yeah, that's one interpretation. But the other interpretation is that, no, it's not referring to eternal generation, but that the Son is unwilling to reveal the hour, which is the interpretation of St. Gregory the Great in his letter to Patriarch of Alexandria. And he gives Act 1:7, where our Lord says that it's not for you to know the hour that the Father has set forth by his own authority. So, yeah, there are two interpretations. And there is another one which says, yeah, the Son does not know the hour in his human nature, but that's not really, I don't think that would be true. I think it's just false because St. Thomas didn't hold that view.
So true.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I was reflecting this morning on something St. Thomas says in Prima Pars Question. Let me see if I can share my screen. So after that interpretive, let's actually do some good theological reflection here. So Adam, when does he talk about this? State concerning the intellect. So it would be question 94, whether he knew all things. So basically what he says here is that Adam had to know everything that was requisite for being the father of all men, because he needed to be able to pass on knowledge. He needed to be able to teach. He needed to be equipped in his role to know all things. That he needed to know. That's a very important caveat. Mm-hmm. So Adam didn't know like the amount of stones in a stream or whatever, but he knew the names of all things, for example, or the natures of all things in which he could name them from. So when it comes to Christ, Christ is the head of his mystical body.
Yeah.
Also needs to know all things for that role, and that role of interceding with the Father. On our behalf, that role of offering a propitiation for mankind, those roles require that he not be ignorant of anything that a man could know, because he is redeeming man and drawing him up to a supernatural state. So, theologically speaking, it's really, frankly, ridiculous to deny, to take the agnoite position. And to say that Christ is ignorant of things like the day or the hour, whatever.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I've heard that Saint Athanasius held that view.
Really? It doesn't surprise me. It seems like earlier. So there's an interesting essay from Newman, actually, on this. Mm-hmm. Let me pull it off my shelf. If I can ever remember where it is. Oh, here it is. Roman Catholic Writings on Doctrinal Development. So Newman, he talks about this in terms of, on his essay, De Catholici Dogmatis Evolutione, Where is he? He talks about this basically in terms of errors that could be widely held amongst church fathers. It's actually a really good essay. Man, I'm just going to sit here and just keep saying, okay. Oh, here it is. Dang, it's not there. I will find it. Oh no. If I don't find this, it's going to be horrible. Dang, this is such a rip. Oh yeah, you guys are just going to sit here for like 3 minutes just watching me try to look through this book in vain for the section in which he talks about this. Here it is. Oh, so true. I found it. Okay. So this is Thesis 9. Thus, it will appear, and fittingly enough, that since truth is won and given to the church from the beginning, even those not quite Catholic things that Catholics have brought forth will generally strike so uncertain and ambiguous a note that, in any serious manner, they prove amenable to pious interpretation. This is really important, I think, with the discussion surrounding the Immaculate Conception, whether St. Thomas believed it or not, is even if you're going to take the position that St. Thomas doesn't teach it, when it comes to those things that are difficulties, the difficulties usually are so ambiguous that they're liable to pious interpretation, which we should piously interpret things. I won't say the details, but somebody did ask me to debate somebody on whether St. Thomas believe the Immaculate Conception or not. And that just struck me like very wrong. Like you're asking me basically to like uncover my father's nakedness, thing exactly. From like, from the book of Genesis. You're asking me to just like say, hey, let's take this point of whether one of my fathers was a heretic and let's put this out there in front of everybody to judge.
Yeah.
That's just not the sort of disposition of a Catholic when it comes to our fathers in the faith. They're liable to pious interpretation. So he continues saying, one example should suffice for this thesis. It is well known among serious students of theology that some of the fourth century fathers spoke of the knowledge of Christ's soul in such a way as to suggest that they did not believe it to have been perfect from the very moment of his conception in Mary's womb, but to have begun growing as he advanced in age, as the evangelist says. It is Catholic dogma. Notice he says it's Catholic dogma.
Yeah.
It's Catholic dogma that the man or human nature assumed by the word did not have, abstractly speaking, or in first act, as they say, perfect knowledge, but that really, or in second act, he did have it, because man was deified in the word. Christ as a man would never have been ignorant of anything a man could know. As Gregory the Great expresses it, he knew in the nature, but not from the nature of his humanity. What did Athanasius write before the heretical agnoite arose concerning the day of judgment? Quote, that hour in which all will end, he knew as the word, but as man, he was ignorant of it, for ignorance is a property of man. Mindful of this, in similar texts of Athanasius and others, Batavius writes, quote, some Catholics, including some of great fame and distinction in the church, attributed ignorance to the man Christ, especially ignorance about the final day and last judgment. Examples are Athanasius, Gregory Nazianzen, Cyril, Hilary, and Ambrose. A little further on, he adds a warning that this opinion, although once acceptable to some very outstanding men, was later characterized, notice, as heresy. And heretics condemned under the heading were called agnoite. But if we, and then this is the end of the quote. But, so this is the pious interpretation part of it. But if we take a closer look at the text of these fathers, we shall not find it difficult to interpret them in a Catholic sense. We need only attach a note to those texts, the effect that being found in writings of those who came before the developed dogma of Christ's knowledge. They sketch the truths of the gospel in broader lines. There are many reasons for believing that those fathers, when they said that Christ as a man was ignorant of the judgment day, meant that he was ignorant from, not in, his human nature. Mm-hmm. That is, his ignorance was not real, but only economic, as suited humanity in itself, or as suited the office or role he was understanding. As when he asked, where shall we buy bread for them to eat? Even though he himself knew what he was going to do. For Athanasius writes that Christ's ignorance, quote, does not pertain to the word, but to the human nature of which ignorance is a property, end quote. Quote, since he was made man, he is not ashamed on account of ignorant flesh to say, I do not know, thereby showing himself to be knowing as God, but not knowing according to the flesh, end quote. Again, quote, let us acknowledge that the word, not ignorant insofar as it was the word, said, I do not know, yet did indeed know, end quote. Yeah, and then he goes on discussing the different fathers and how they absolutely could be read in a pious way on this matter.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. But basically, like, this kind of, I feel among modern Catholics, you get this a lot, especially with discussions surrounding St. Thomas. With modern Catholics, they are very, very quick to hold to like a magisterial positivism and just say like, oh, that was just a church father. Like, they're not infallible, right? And then they just kind of throw them out and will be very quick to impute error to our fathers, where somebody like St. John Henry Newman, or basically the entire medieval tradition, would refuse to like be so quick as to impute error to our fathers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, if you read Denzinger, he's going to cite St. Gregory's letter to Patriarch of Alexandria. So it seems that this is the authoritative interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Father Michael Nasr Ali, do you remember this discussion?
The Anglican bishop who became Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was like very vigorously arguing for the Agnoite position. Yeah.
Okay.
And he said it's basically a theological, like St. Thomas's position is a theological opinion. But clearly, clearly, there's been a very long recognition.
That's not really nice. But, yeah.
Okay, so here's a question. Oh, somebody gave us a super chat, which is a reminder.
Yeah.
Super chats, those are nice. Okay, so just want to support you for answering my questions a few months ago in regards to biblical critics. Please remember me in your prayers. I'm joining seminary in a country that is very liberal but needs priests. Thanks again. So true.
So,
thank you, brother.
So based. God bless you.
Dude, going to seminary, I couldn't imagine going to seminary in like a liberal country nowadays. That would be horrible.
It'd be really hard, yeah.
You kind of have to live, like, in order to just make it through alive, you kind of have to be as like wise as a serpent. And obviously not lie, but you're going to have to like equivocate and conceal like a lot of times what you actually believe on some issues.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, the Diocese of St. Augustine banned the TLM.
No.
Rip. So what's the doctrine of God and Shia?
Okay. So the doctrine of God and Shiism. So Shias, unlike Sunnis, believe in divine simplicity. So it's kind of dogmatic for them to believe in divine simplicity, but the divine simplicity that they believe in is different from our conception. There's not even one conception of divine simplicity in Catholic tradition. But anyway, so the two dominant positions are one that comes from narration. So this view is that basically divides God's attributes into attributes of essence and attributes of action. So the attributes of essence are those that only pertain to essence and would exist regardless of God creating or acting or anything, basically anything that has to do with action. On the other hand, the attributes of action have to do with how God acts. So, for example, they do not say that God has a will before creation. When they say that God has a will, they mean that if he creates, he has a will. So the moment that God wills is the effect for them. So the will and the effect are synonymous for Shias. Only those Shias who follow the narrations. So will, mercy, justice, creative action, these are considered to be attributes of action and thus really distinct from God and created. They're just the thing itself. So when they say act of creation, they mean nothing other than creation itself. So when, and when they say God willed X to happen, they mean nothing other than X itself. This is the narration's theology. And then there's a philosophers, traditional philosophers, like people like Mullah Sadra and Khaji Nasiruddin Tusi, they try to reconcile the hadith view with that of natural theology, because if somebody knows about natural theology, they know that it's impossible for God's will to be created, because Aristotle proves that willing is an immanent action. So they have to find some way to reconcile these views. And this is why people like Mullah Sadra try to say that God's will is distinguished into twofold category. First is God's will for himself and God's will for creation. So the first one is basically uncreated, eternal, identical to his essence. But the second one is just created. But that, again, is still problematic, because willing is an immanent action. You cannot arbitrarily say that there's one will, one kind of will, which is transient, the other immanent. So the difference is this, that they try to reconcile the apparent contradiction in the narrations with the natural theology. And some of those Shia theologians are necessitarians. So they believe that God necessarily created the world. So they believe that God could not have refrained from creating the world. It had to be done. That's the Shia view. So yeah, they believe in divine simplicity, but their conception is erroneous. And we would argue that it's actually really anthropomorphic, because it makes divine agency as a created agent who acts by multiple actions to turn out the very essence of the agent.
So true.
Yeah, so explanation.
So actually what's interesting is that from natural reason we can know that only the Catholic position is true.
Exactly.
Because we can know that, well, I mean, I guess some sort of Protestantism might be able to accept.
Yeah, because they believe, yeah.
But if we're just like assuming, okay, apostolic churches and other religions, any other religion in the world, including Shia Islam, is not going to be able to accept the Thomistic position on the will of God.
Yeah,
and the other apostolic,
the
other apostolic churches as well aren't going to be able to accept that. So, yeah. Allegedly. Now there we go. Here we go, Astro.
Okay.
Yeah, we got you.
You got me, dude.
So how does divine simplicity still keep divine freedom intact?
Oh, this is going to be tough. I don't know if you're familiar with scholasticism, but okay. So the way we define freedom in Thomism is active indifference of God's most simple act with regard to several different secondary objects. So to start with, you have to know that acts are specified by their objects. So because when you want to act, you act to, and your act is specified by some object. So for example, let's say that you want to travel to Spain or any place you want, right? Your action has Spain as its end. Now, if you can travel on your foot, if you can't travel on your foot, you have to take some means by which the end can be accomplished. Like you have to go on plane or on boat or anything. So those are means by which the end, which is going to Spain, is achieved. Now, those are both objects, but one is primary and the other is secondary. So now God likewise has primary and secondary objects of the divine volition. So the primary object of the divine volition is the divine essence itself. God wills himself of absolute necessity. God cannot choose not to love himself. It's absolutely necessary, natural for God to love himself. But because God by absolute necessity loves himself, we can show that God's love or goodness can exist without creatures. So God's goodness in no way depends on those secondary objects, which are the creatures or means that are ordered to the divine goodness. And since that's the case, there's no necessity on the part of God's action to necessarily choose these objects, which are called secondary objects. So what we say is that God's freedom is active indifference of God's most simple action, not power, because God never moves from having power to going to act, because God, unlike creatures, has an eternal action, not a temporal action. So we creatures move from having power to act. So our freedom is defined as a potency which is open to different actions. But since God never begins to act, his freedom is not defined as potency in relation to different actions, but action in relation to different objects. So from all eternity, God has an eternal action, and that eternal action can have different secondary objects. Okay? And that's how we say that God is free, because God's act of willing does not depend on those secondary objects, but only on the primary object, which is his essence. And this distinction is called action taken entitatively versus action called terminatively. So the action is entitatively necessary because God cannot lack the action, because freedom is a perfection. But terminatively, there is no necessity for God's action to terminate at creatures, because there's no necessity for him to will them, because his will doesn't depend on secondary objects.
True.
Yeah.
What is analytic philosophy? No idea. Next question. My phone. Who's texting me? Stop texting me. I'm not answering your questions. Oh man. Here's your second favorite one. Could you say that the Father, that the Son is Ase, or is only the Father Ase?
Okay, so I wrote an article on this.
As a future note, Fola, Ase is A space
S-E-I. Yeah. It's not A-S-E-I. It's A-S-E. Okay, so I wrote an article on this. It was a reply to Dr. Khalil Andani. He's a Shia Muslim. You can check it. I'm going to post the link in the chat. There you go. So when we say aseity, that can mean many different things. So in one sense, aseity just means something that is uncaused by way of four Aristotelian causes: formal, final, efficient, and material cause. So in that sense, divine nature and all three persons are uncaused, because the Son and the Spirit are not caused by an active and efficient cause, because that would make them creatures. So if you define aseity by being uncaused in four Aristotelian senses, four Aristotelian causes, then all three persons and the divine essence are ase. But there is another sense of aseity, which means that there is no, the thing doesn't have any principle, not that it doesn't have any cause. So the difference between principle and cause is that cause refers to that thing, but principle can refer to things that are consubstantial and do not imply any dependence. For example, a line proceeds from a point, right? So in things that have a principle, there's only an order of origin or explanation, not a dependency, properly speaking. And in this sense, it's only God the Father who doesn't have a principle of origin, because divine essence is not communicated to the Father. He has it of himself. And when we say he has it of himself, we don't mean in a positive sense, meaning he's self-principled, but he's unprincipled, meaning that so aseity is not defined in the positive sense. God doesn't cause himself to be, rather he's uncaused. In the same sense, Father is not its own principle, rather he's unprincipled. But the Son and the Spirit, because they have their essence and all other perfections from the Father, and the Spirit has it from the Father and the Son, they are not personally ase, if by ase we mean a principle of origin. So in that sense, in the sense of having a principle of origin, only the Father and the divine essence are ase, not the Father, not the Son and the Spirit. But that doesn't mean they're not God, because the principle of origin does not imply any dependency, imperfection, or anything, but only expresses an order of origin, and that's it.
Okay, so here's a fun one. Why doesn't the Catholic Church make an infallible list of dogmas? Can she do this?
Hmm.
I don't know. she's told us basically when it comes to those things, like on just like a general lay level, because I feel like people still kind of think of this in a quasi-Protestant way. I was thinking about this the other day. People kind of think about this in a weirdly Protestant way of how dogmas work. Because basically, let's take like the Agnoite heresy for an example. The fact that Christ, his humanity and virtue of his hypostatic union, of the humanity's hypostatic union with the eternal word, by the grace of union, has all knowledge that is possible for man in second act.
Yeah.
That is a dogma of the Catholic Church. Now, are there any like your average layman out there? They go to the pearly gates. St. Peter comes out and says, "Okay, what are the list of dogmas you had to believe in order to be saved?" And they forget that one, and they just get thrown into hell. It's not how it works. Rather, when it comes to like your normal sort of lay level, average, you know, person, it's basically just like the Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, like that. That's what are the articles of the faith. Those are the articles of the faith. All of those other things, usually there isn't a strict requirement for laymen to explicitly know those things. Rather, we can make an implicit act of faith by saying that we can make an act of faith which implicitly entails those things by saying that we believe God and all that God has revealed through the divine legate, Jesus Christ, and the church which he has established to be his legate until the end of the age. But when it comes to theologians, what I just said about the Agnoite heresy, that's going to be something that theologians need to know. That's very important. If you're going to teach Christology, you're going to need to know that. And the church has, through her magisterial acts, told us when she's teaching, at what degree she's teaching, and so on and so forth. And the church has established, this is what a lot of people forget, but the church has established the theological schools and has established the sort of system of manuals. Not as much anymore. There's not really that much oversight, but at least historically, this was the sort of ordinary means for teaching students theology. Has established the schools of theology in order to interpret and teach the deposit of faith and to communicate the teaching of the magisterium to the people that do need to know these truths. So since the church is prudent, she doesn't necessarily immediately kind of like work within everything. That's why it took so long for the church to have an official universal catechism as well. The church just didn't see it necessary until the 20th century to make a universal catechism. Because I mean, the ordinary means is just, you know, bishops making local catechisms or bishops' conferences making catechisms. And for us moderns, we kind of just say like, no, we need like the sort of, you know, ex cathedra list of dogmas. Or whatever, but the church has just established the schools as means of you know, communicating her teaching, both definitive and non-definitive, to generations of theologians. So I hope that's a helpful answer, at least.
That's actually great.
Oh wow. Okay, so. So yes, you are a fanatical Thomas on
Twitter. Yeah, it's not fanatical, it's fanatic, yeah. But yeah, I'm that guy.
Is being, does being be? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so which saints do I have devotion to? Which devotion and why that saint? Saint Thomas. I would say most of my at least my current, and since I've become Catholic, most of my devotional life has been centered around the Passion. So something like the Stations of the Cross has really been my jam for extraordinary devotions. Although I also obviously have a devotion to St. Thomas, and especially to the angelic cord of St. Thomas, for the preservation and building of the virtue of chastity. I think it's very, very, very important. As Pius the 11th teaches, if our angelic doctor did not win his, if St. Thomas did not win his battle over the flesh, we would not have the angelic doctor.
So true.
And that's why he's called the angelic doctor, because of his angelic purity.
Yeah, exactly.
And as St. Thomas teaches in another place, when it comes to our bodies will be spiritual, as St. Paul says, why will they be spiritual in the eschaton? Well, they'll be spiritual because our bodies are going to be completely submitted to our intellects. And the well-ordered mind has the taming of the flesh, the taming of the concupiscence of the flesh. And this most vehemently comes through the generative faculties. So it's most important, really, for people to, and this is why we mention it so much, is it's most important for people to become chaste if they want to become holy and become learned. Is becoming chaste is really a prerequisite, and it's very, very, very important. And that's why that specific devotion from St. Thomas is one that I have. I can't think of many. I have a very strong devotion to the daily office. So usually when it comes to extraordinary devotions, I don't have that many.
What about rosary?
Rosary? I know I'm about to get like murdered for this. So yes, the rosary, according to the teachings of the popes, is the most important private devotion of the faithful.
Okay.
But for me personally, I do pray the rosary. Do I have a rosary? I pray it. My wife prays it a lot more than I do. Prays the rosary a lot more than I do as a private devotion. It's just not something that has been, you know, part of my spiritual physiognomy. I've never heard
physiognomy?
That word.
Physiognomy.
Physiognomy is it? How do you pronounce that word? I've heard. It hasn't been something which is like physiognomy. That's how you pronounce it. Physiognomy. It hasn't been part of my spiritual physiognomy. Which is actually a term that the spiritual writers will use, is spiritual physiognomy. I get why you have your daily rosary gang, sort of people that are just like daily rosary, and then there's definitely been popes that have focused in that direction.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
Yeah, you're a daily rosary enjoyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I do pray the rosary, I usually just do mental prayer, meditating upon the different mysteries of the rosary. I do have a difficult time engaging in mixed mental prayer, so vocal prayer and mental prayer at the same time. I've tried it again and again and again. It just doesn't work.
It just
becomes more of like a distraction to me. And then it feels like, okay, I'm just trying to like fit in X number of Hail Marys and apparently contemplate this mystery. I don't think I've met people where the rosary is something that's just like, okay, like 15 decades a day, boys. And that's like my entire spiritual life, and I don't need anything else. And that's fine. But just not for me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Man, there's How is Mark 13:32 interpreted in a non-agnoite way? We actually, I'm sorry that you gave a super chat for this, because if you scroll back to earlier in the video, we literally spent like 15 minutes on this question. Sorry, you're there. It was wrong, and it just threw me off.
But by the way, if you want to read on that, on Mark 13:32, just go to Denzinger, page 97, where you're going to see St. Gregory the Great's interpretation.
This is a similar one. St. Newman's Grammar of Assent covers what we know, what we assent to on faith with certainty, and it really comes down to the illative sense, which is different for the average lay and a theologian, for example. The illative sense has always kind of been a struggle for me to accept from Newman, because it can be taken in a right way and it can be taken in a wrong way. So habits are specified by their formal object. So as Banya says, if you deny the risibility of Christ, you're not a heretic. A heretic does not make but a bad philosopher. Where when it comes to the scotistic and nominalistic schools, what they're going to say is basically like, actually, if you are somebody who knows about the fact that risibility is a property of humanity, and you know that Christ has humanity, and you're a very high theologian, and you deny the risibility of Christ, you're denying the faith. So if by the illative sense, you're talking about what Scotus is talking about, which is basically that there is some sort of intrinsic rather than extrinsic specification of habits, then no, I don't accept it. And I think it's actually a bit dangerous to accept that. And it turns the faith into a matter of like bigger and smaller brains. But if you mean by that, basically that there is differing levels of culpability, like you're taking this in a sort of moral way of like the type of culpability that you can have for knowing versus not knowing various things, depending on the sort of impression that is made of the articles within the mind of a believer, then I think that could be acceptable within the school of St. Thomas, and then I would accept the illative sense. I've really, really, really struggled with accepting the illative sense, because I think it might deny the specification, the proper view, the Thomistic view of the specification of habits. But that is a story for a different day. So to your question, would there be a huge consequence for a Catholic salvation if they rejected the Assumption of Our Lady? It would depend. I mean, I'm sure you can think of faithful Catholics out there whose catechesis is so horrible that they somehow have completely missed the idea of the Assumption of Our Lady, or you know how a lot of these things are spread. Like, we're internet people with internet Catholicism, so we think, okay, you know, we're going to read our catechisms, we're going to read this, we're going to ask somebody who's knowledgeable, blah, 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 blah. They probably just ask, like, their grandma tells them something, and they're just like, oh, okay, I guess that's what the church teaches in a lot of places. Or you know, their priest just said it once, or a deacon or something. And what you get with a lot of these people is, for some of them, they literally might not be aware, and they... this might be invincible. They might just not be aware that the Assumption of Our Lady is a dogma of the faith. Like, they might have been taught that it's a pious opinion, and then they just might be like, well, that doesn't make sense. And blah, blah. So it's possible. But if you know that it's a dogma of the faith and you reject it, you're going to hell. That's just
true. It's that simple.
It really is that simple. So I distinguish, I guess, on this question. But yeah, okay. I guess that's all. I mean, I have a lot of starred questions. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think about Joshua Sigilati's new model, the Trinity?
It's certainly better than the previous model, but I would just ask him, why do we need this model? Like, what's the necessity for proposing this analytic model? What's in your model that our model, namely deterministic or even scholastic or Suarez conception of the Trinity, cannot respond? Why do we even need that? That's the only question I would ask.
True. Okay, so somebody asked. So this is a good question. So what is your response to people who claim that motives of credibility provide only a mass of probabilities, the merit of such investigation can be wrong, and it is not a good method to determine the true church? Well, my first response is, if this person's a Catholic, then they're a heretic, because the church has defined in Vatican I the proper method of determining. And if you don't believe me on this, I will pull up De Filius on this. There's the let him be anathema and everything on there. Is it only in Latin? Oh gosh, this is gonna be fun. Whatever Google Translate gives me is good enough. So they give an anathema to the proposition. Okay, so if someone says that divine revelation cannot be made credible by external signs, and therefore that people must be moved to faith only by each person's internal experience or private inspiration, let them be anathema. So it is under anathema if you're going to deny that by external signs we can't make credible divine revelation. So it is a heresy, and they're a heretic from this. Vatican I has defined the proper mode of apologetics. There's just no question about it. So if that person is a Catholic, that would be my first response, is to stop being a heretic. And my second response is the fact that those things are not masses of probabilities. I mean, it's just like, if somebody performs a miracle, and you know that miracle is something which is above the powers of created things, that's not a probability. You have physical certainty that that God is stamping his approval on this. That's true. That's like saying that the fact that your friend was actually, the fact that Socrates is rational is something which is just a probability. We know that Socrates is a man. We know that an essential note of humanity is rationality. Therefore, we can know with certainty, flowing from his essence, that Socrates is rational. It's not a mere probability that you get from investigating a bunch of people and seeing whether they're rational. No. It's something which is certain from the natures of things. So it's just like some sort of like weird quasi-Cartesian, just like weirdness about like certainty obsession that you get. So yeah, that's I guess that would be my response to that off the cuff. So Astra, anything to add?
No, but what if Cartesian demon is deceiving us?
What if the Cartesian demon is deceiving us?
Yeah.
Oh, man, bro. I don't know. Well, actually, I think it's actually just relatively easy. Just if you read any sort of discussion of it, sometimes it's called defensive metaphysics, criteriology, whatever. You see that the first principles of reason are things that can be demonstrated indirectly by way of reductio ad absurdum. Mm-hmm. So you know the first principles of reason, and from the first principle of reason, you can reason things. It's not like insanely convoluted, our answer to that.
Yeah.
Which leads to this question that somebody gave about, no, not this one, not this one, not this one, not this one. There you go. Which manual would you suggest to read over the other? Cardinal Mercier or Grenier? Grenier. Okay.
Yeah.
Which, as a reminder, if you go to that link below, I've actually reprinted Grenier. Four volumes in one, Thomistic Philosophy.
Yeah.
Only $34.99, which if you buy all of the volumes individually, that's going to be a lot more than that. So check that out. Link below. Oh,
yeah. Get the Christian's version.
True, because it's better as well. It's Do I have my copy around? Oh, it's in my car. Ugh. I was reading it while I was driving. I'm joking. I wasn't doing that.
That would have been based.
That would be based, reading Grenier while I drive. I was actually in traffic one time so bad, and I had my copy of The Obstacle of Volume 1. So while I was in traffic, I read Dante's Dissentia.
So pissed.
It's great. Faults on David Bentley Hart. He's bad.
He's bad.
When will you debate?
The only based thing about him is that he believes if you don't believe in divine simplicity, you're basically an atheist.
Wait, does he believe that?
Yeah.
Chad? Never mind, I like David Bentley Hart. Okay, so when will I debate Lawton or brother Peter Diamond? I would get obliterated by both of those, so I'm too scared. So how necessary is logic and to what level before approaching theological manuals, as these seem very intelligible without very much study in logic? Well, logic is the instrument of the sciences, my friend.
Yeah.
What you'll get is, I don't think anybody could have an adequate knowledge of Trinitarian doctrine without like having some sort of discussion of the way in which names work, like in the way in which supposition works and so on.
Yeah.
Like being able to categorize names is so important for like that, then De Deo Uno as well. I mean, being able to understand the distinction between concrete and abstract names, and being able to understand the perfections and imperfections of each of those. Just as like a general rule of divine naming. I mean, there's just like, as I read more scholastic philosophy, I recognize the more places that these things come up in a very important way. And like you can't do theology if you don't know how to divide and define, which is, you don't know how to divide and define unless you learn scholastic logic. And there's just a bunch of stuff that scholastic logic is going to overflow into the theological manuals on. Although some of them, do present it in such a way for those who haven't studied it, but those are only going to get you so far. There's going to be a lot of questions that are going to remain unanswered and untreated, or treated in a less than sufficient way, because they're trying to gear it towards those who don't, such as Copens or Hunter, which Copens and Hunter are very good. But yeah. Okay, so as a former Anglican, do you think that there's any hope for a general reunion outside the ordinariate? Or are things too far gone? And what's the minimum Anglicans must accept for a reunion with Rome? To your first question, I don't think so at all. There was a chance before 1977. There was a chance before 1977 when women were ordained in the Episcopal Church. But now, I mean, even in like conservative Anglican circles, like in the ACNA, it's very hard to have the Roman view of gender and clerics. It's very hard. And I think it would be impossible to have them give that up. But the minimum things Anglicans must accept for a reunion with Rome. That's a very hard question to answer, because I mean, to be a bit frank, when you talk to certain members of the Ordinariate, when they entered, they would themselves admit that there was some like serious theological issues that they had upon entering Rome and with some of the things they believed, which, yeah, there were serious issues. So even with something like the Ordinariate, it's still not, or at least wasn't, when these sort of events happened, as like strict sort of like sign your name on the dotted line to these 150 dogmas sort of thing. So yeah, that would be a very long question, but an implicit statement would probably be enough, that one would accept all that the Holy Catholic Church teaches. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Oh, we missed you. Where's Hassan? Oh, we have Astro, who's better than Hassan. Because Hassan's
great.
Okay, is the Augustinian view of divine illumination compatible with Thomism? Well, Thomas teaches divine illumination. So.
He does.
Let me see exactly where he talks about this at length in Prima Pars. I probably won't be able to find it, so I probably won't spend too much time looking for it. But yeah, that's kind of like a scholarship meme right there. Like, oh, St. Thomas doesn't believe in divine illumination. He does. He absolutely does. Because it would kind of be stupid for him not to, especially considering St. Thomas's view that all formal perfections come from participation in the divinity. So, mm-hmm. So like intellection is a pure perfection. So it would have to be something which is comes as illuminated from on high. So basically for St. Thomas, the divine illumination is the agent intellect, which I'm trying to find out where he talks about this. Something which is habitual. And then also, yeah, something which is habitual. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to find it. It's whatever. Whatever I told you, just believe it. Trust the plan. It's so going to be It's going to be somewhere between question 79 and question 89 of Prima Pars is where you're going to find it. So good luck. Let me see. If I search light, I might be able to find it. Oh. Did I find? Oh no! I accidentally went to the angels, dude. Did I find it? The agent intellect is something in the soul. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm not gonna keep looking for that, but. I want to keep looking for it though, where I read it. Yeah, the whole thing that like the Augustinians were illuminationists and the Thomists were not, the Aristotelians were not, blah blah blah. That's literally just a meme. Okay, so
maybe it's an intellectual power section.
Ah. Your Pope Michael video is legendary. God rest his soul. So true.
So, yeah.
Okay. Does Aquinas teach that Protestants/heretics don't have faith as an operative habit, rather merely what he calls a kind of opinion in accordance with his own will? Yes. That's basically the Thomistic position is that heretics are not true theologians. Heretics don't even have dead faith. Because if you think about it, faith is the assent to some sort of revelation on the basis not of the intrinsic evidence, but on the basis of God who reveals. So they would have some sort of opinion in accordance with his own will. Yeah. So I guess that's and that's my response.
Sorry,
but even. I froze.
No, I said sorry, reformed, bros. Reformed.
Oh. But even then, this is a quote, a kind of opinion in accordance with his own will. This is actually a quote from Gary Gu Lagrange's Divine De Revelatione, so obviously I don't disagree with that. Almost got me. Okay, so these are just words, bro. These are just words. Can Catholics be coherentists, or do we have to be Western foundationalists? Like, what do these words even mean, bro? What are these words?
Yeah,
mean?
Exactly.
Just be normal. Just be normal. But yes, but if I think what I think you mean by Western foundationalism, then yes, we have to be Western foundationalists, which I don't know how a Greek ended up being the guy who invented Western foundationalism. And literally, I don't know how this is Western. I mean, like, the East has an entire, like, because where Aristotle talks about this is what, Metaphysics book 4, Metaphysics book 5, where he talks about defensive metaphysics. I can't remember which book. But in one of them, he talks about it. And the East has an entire, like, history of a commentorial tradition on Aristotle, commenting and supporting that view of first principles. And you have the Eastern fathers, like John of Damascus, read his philosophical chapters, read it. He's going off of Ammonius. That's who he's, Ammonius or probably Ammonius. I was probably right on that one. But like, I don't get why this is like Western foundationalism. This is just what normal people believe.
Yeah.
Okay, Prots don't even have faith. How does this square up with Vatican II, though? Prots don't even have faith. I guess I should probably have clarified. Prots qua Prots don't have faith, but it's possible for a Protestant to have faith in certain extraordinary circumstances. Okay, thank you for... Was Luther predestined to drink himself to death? I don't think he drank himself to death. Okay, so I think I answered all the recent ones, but I do have some starred questions. Okay, so do you think Eastern Orthodox have produced evidence that their doctrines haven't developed, or is this just insane cope? It is insane cope. Absolutely. I mean, like something like energetic manifestation. Like, that's literally schizo to say that this was something that, like, the apostles taught. It's literally schizo. It's schizophrenic. Oh, you. Oh, he muted himself. Rip.
What?
Oh, you muted yourself. But it's just the lit. I thought you were going to make fun of energetic manifestation for a second.
Yeah, it's basically an old doctrine that did not exist in the Greek fathers. I mean, Eastern Orthodox found out that Philodius' explanation of John 16:15 was insufficient, so they had to come up with some explanation to try to justify that interpretation. Because temporal sending is not what the passage is teaching. That's literally a cope. And that's why then Gregory of Cyprus, who was the patriarch of Constantinople, come up with this idea of energetic manifestation or eternal manifestation. John Bickus, he should be a saint, by the way. Saint John Bickus. Yeah, he literally refuted him a year after he convened the synod on 1285, the Synod of Blackrene, showing that it's literally novel and it did not exist in the fathers. And even if he allowed that language of eternal manifestation, John Bickus shows that it's nothing but the eternal hypostatic procession of the Spirit.
Yeah, what is eternal manifestation even supposed to be, bro?
It's like energies are eternally manifested through the song.
Who are you manifesting to? Like, what is this, bro? I eternal manifestation.
It's like, if you deny the filioque, you're not going to have a perfect, what's it called? Interpenetration of the persons. I forgot.
Concatenation? There's also not a perfect concatenation between the persons.
Yeah, What was the concept? I forgot the word for that. Can't remember.
Circumcision. Perichoresis.
Perichoresis. Yeah, you're not going to have perfect perichoresis if you deny the filioque, because the father is in the son, by essence, relation and origin, right? But if that's not the case about the relation between the son and the spirit, then son is not going to be in the spirit either by way of essence, relation, or origin. So your perichoresis is going to be deficient. It's only going to be a perfect perichoresis between the father and the spirit.
Yeah, Shivan has such a good section on how the denial of the filioque mutilates the Trinity.
Exactly.
Yeah. He has 12 different ways in which it mutilates, separates, and confuses. It's like it literally every single possible error on every single angle. They somehow both confuse the persons and also rip apart the persons.
Yeah.
This is why a lot of people ask me about all of this stuff about essence energies distinction, and ask me about papacy, and ask me about a bunch of this stuff. Mm. But it's like literally the clearest thing that I've come to realize, the most obvious thing where the Latins are just right on is a filioque.
Yeah, exactly.
The filioque is like, it's obviously true. Filioque is obviously true from scripture, from theological reasoning, from tradition, from like so many different angles. And really the type of insane coping that you have to engage in to say like that Saint Augustine didn't affirm, like Saint Augustine affirmed energetic manifestation, like it's literally insanity. It ought to be classed as like a mental illness to say things like this. So that is the area where I am just most confident in.
Yeah.
Like, just filioque. If we stick with the filioque all day, I'm happy, because it's just obvious that the East got this really, 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 really wrong in a very damaging way.
I mean, that filioque alone proves that Eastern churches can never be right, because they have dogmatically anathematized this position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so can Catholics have the news? No, we can't have the news, bro.
No.
Okay, so it was a culpable denial of a doctrine, fide proxima. There should be an E there, by the way. Sufficient for anathema.
I think there's a section on this in STS, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, because they would it's at the beginning of the STS. I have my copy. I can pull it up. But there's different, like, both canonical and then there's moral derelicts to denying different grades of theological notes. Actually, I know there's like a really good table for this. Let me see if I can find the table for it. Let me just look at images, Google images. This is stupid, bro. I'm trying to find it. I can't find it. Dang, there's like a really, really good table on this. I need to find that thing. It talks about like the canonical derelict, because there's a difference between the canonical and the moral derelict. Because is it on the SSPX website? I think if it's on the SSPX website, Sententia Fide Proxima. Crap, it isn't. Maybe they mention it though. Obviously, we know it's proximate to error, bro. It doesn't talk about. Yeah, sorry. I just can't find it. There's a canonical derelict, which is the level of condemnation, which would be proximate to error. And then there's also like a moral derelict as well. Because anything from like denying a dogma of the faith is you don't even have dead faith, to all the way to like something can just be like venially sinful. Dang. Okay, so I have okay, 5-starred. I think this is literally a question, like a quote question from St. Augustine. Did the Father voluntarily or involuntarily beget the Son? If involuntarily, how could the Father do something without willing it? If voluntarily, how could the Son be necessary? Go on.
We've been debunked.
Go on.
Oh, okay. So yeah, people think that this is a contradiction because some fathers say that Father begot the Son by nature, others... And the same fathers assert that the Father begot the Son willingly. So we need to distinguish what we mean by will. So we define will in three different ways. So there's will, there's will as nature, and there's concomitant will. So will as will is just the way will is understood by everybody. So meaning that you're free to act in this way or in that way. So there's a contingent choice. You can choose this, you can choose that, or you can choose neither of them. So in this sense, the Father did not beget the Son. So if you refer to will, Father begetting the Son by will, in this sense, the Father did not beget the Son willingly. There's another sense of the term will. It's will as nature. So in this sense, we refer to natural will of something. So for example, a man by his natural will wills his own happiness and goodness. In the same way, God loves his own happiness and goodness by his will. But God doesn't choose to love himself. It's natural. So God cannot refrain from willing his own goodness. And in this sense, the Son is still not begotten by the Father, because this is the mode of procession of the Holy Spirit, because it's the Holy Spirit who's loved the Father and the Son. So not even in this sense, the Son could be said to be begotten voluntarily. But in the last sense, it's called concomitant will. And what this means is that what you are by nature is not against your will. So when we say that Father begot the Son by nature or by intellect, his will is not against this act of generation. And in this sense, it is in this sense that fathers say this: the Father begot the Son willingly. They do not mean that will is the principle of Son's generation. No, the principle of Son's generation is the divine nature or divine intellect. But when we say that the Father begot Son willingly, we simply mean that the Father, when he begets the Son by nature, the begetting of the Son by nature is not against his will. And as for the Spirit, you can already guess what the response is. In the first sense, which is free, there is no procession of the Spirit. In the second sense, there is, because the Spirit naturally proceeds from the will of the Father and the Son. And in the last sense, which is concomitant will, it is also true of the Spirit, because when Father naturally aspires the Spirit, when the Father and the Son naturally aspire the Holy Spirit, their aspirating is not against the divine will. So concomitant will is applicable both to the generation of the Son and aspiration of the Spirit. The first mode of will, which is will as free, is not applicable to any of them. It's only applicable to creation. And in the second sense, which is will as nature, it's applicable to the Holy Spirit, because he proceeds by way of will, by way of natural will, but the Son does not proceed by way of will, but by way of nature or intellect. There you go.
Okay. Oh, so this is actually exactly what we're saying. If a Catholic had a disposition where if they found out a certain dogma was true, they would have a crisis of faith. Oh, wait. No. Ooh. Okay. Opposite of that. I thought you were saying the opposite of that. So if a Catholic had a disposition where if they found out a certain dogma was true, they would have a certain crisis of faith and couldn't accept it, but don't know the dogma, could they be saved? No. The disposition that would be a sin against faith. That'd be a sin against faith. Yeah, I thought you were saying the opposite of this. No, you have to, after the disposition to which whatever whatever is revealed, you assent to. But that's, yeah. Okay. Okay, so let me see if there's anything. I'm going to answer one more question and then I'm going to go. Okay. You guys have one chance. One chance.
One last chance.
One last chance. Yeah, maybe I should just like close my eyes and scroll up and click a random.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. No, what, no, we already answered that. Okay. What are your thoughts on Joshua Sijuan? Okay, no.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. This is a good
one. Okay.
When talking about the divine act, is it orthodox to say God will necessarily act, but not necessarily act in any certain manner? I'm assuming you say.
No, because God doesn't necessarily act, because that would be necessitarianism. Rather, we mean that God's act of healing himself is absolutely necessary, but it's only suppositionally necessary that God wills to create, meaning that if he chooses to create, it's necessary that he creates, not that he has to create by absolute necessity. So you cannot say God necessarily acts.
Okay, that was your last one.
Yeah,
guys. Okay, thank you, Astro. This was very fun.
Thank you too.
It was very fun.
Yeah.
I need to get Lexi to make some clips of some of those answers. Those would be useful for just like when you get the same questions 8 trillion times. Just send the video, because we know people like to read anyways. So thank you, everybody, and as always, God bless.